Hey, it's Alison from the Auckland Libraries. We're taking a break this week, so we've picked one of our favourite shows from the archives for you. Enjoy!
Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah, standing there.
Kia ora, I'm here today with Joanne Drayton, and we'll be talking about her new book, Hudson and Hall's The Food of Love, which has just made it on to the Auckland Library's top 100 titles of 2018, I'm happy to say. Kia ora, Jo. Thanks for coming in.
Kia ora. Good to be here.
This is Jo's second visit to Books and Beyond. Last April, we talked about The Art of the Biography, which you can access as a podcast. Joanne is, in fact, an esteemed biographer, author of a number of acclaimed and groundbreaking biographies, among which The Search for Anne Perry, a New York Times bestseller, and Closer to Home, featured on the cover of The Listener. Your book's featured on a record number of Listener covers, am I right?
Yes. Yeah. It always amazes me, but I'm thrilled.
It's quite an honor. So the new book, speaking of celebrities, I think we can, Listener covers takes us well into to continue, which is that the new book is about celebrity chefs, in particular Peter Hudson and David Halls, known as Hudson and Halls. I want to say I haven't yet met anyone when I've talked about this book who has said who, but I think that maybe we should give it a go. There might be someone out there, not in my age group, who might be wondering.
Good idea.
If maybe you could just, in a few words, you'd be much more qualified than I to describe who were Hudson and Halls, and especially who were they for New Zealand. I really love the phrase that you use in the book, two ordinary lives which became extraordinary.
Right. Yeah, well, Hudson and Halls were celebrity chefs. They came to our attention dramatically on TV at a time when TV was huge. So they were gay, they were celebrity chefs, and they were performers. And they took New Zealand by storm to a large degree. It was a slow thing in that they started, well, actually not that slow, but they started with a very short 10-minute segment on Speakeasy in 1975 and then exploded into primetime television the year after. So, and they were right in people's consciousness. They were there. They were funny. So they were comedic, funny entertainers. They were introducing New Zealand to a new range of food and ideas about food and cooking, particularly alcohol. And you know, New Zealand really embraced them.
And it was a time when New Zealand was very, homosexuality was not, well, as you actually describe it in the book, you could be hanged for murder in that time in New Zealand. Abortion was illegal and homosexuality as well. And yet these people were in everyone's living rooms, gay, but not talking about being gay.
That's right. Yeah, they were very flamboyantly camp. Their routine was the sort of domestic kitchen, two guys fighting, arguing, bitching, bickering, that sort of thing, in a way that was very intimate.
Yeah.
And funny, and kind of funny, and sometimes
I think we can say funny, witty,
yeah,
witty, perhaps more than funny, in the sense that they weren't objects of fun.
No, not at all. Yeah. David was slightly slapstick, and Peter was dry and very clever and witty, and they made the perfect team.
Yeah,
and so they really attracted New Zealand, a more staid viewer, a conservative New Zealander, into this kitchen that was actually the relationship between two men who loved each other,
yeah,
and fought and did all the things that people do when they love each other and things mean things So, you know, I think often we don't fight if we don't care.
Yeah, you do mention in the book, and I think it's very well stated, I didn't know the particular name of the show, but about previous shows on UK television where characters had featured who, if you knew gay people, you knew they were gay, but the role was presented almost as an asexual, so they had the gay subculture or the codes and the certain ways of moving and speaking, but the personality was presented as something asexual to not bother people too much by the fact that if you made the sexuality too apparent, it would be too much for people.
Absolutely.
And yet these two men did manage to actually show themselves as an intimate couple.
That's right.
Yeah, I think
that was actually definitely a shift, and it was a shift, interestingly enough, in front of a New Zealand audience. So I think those two men, they were Australian. Peter was an Australian. Peter Hudson. David Halls was from Epping, and so they came to New Zealand, and they bought something that was maybe foreign to some extent. Mm-hmm. And when I say foreign, I mean not something we would be used to seeing on stage or in our lounge regularly. Though there was always the Carry On Camping and the Carry On movies, which were always a lot that always had that gay character in it. But we were not used to seeing it homegrown. This was homegrown camp. It was. Domestic, you know, it was domestic. It was in our lounge, which was a new experience as well for New Zealanders because TV was really defining our lives by that stage. The whole orientation of the lounge shifted towards this kind of almost like a shrine, this glowing shrine, the television monitor in the lounge, and so our whole life was, interestingly enough, orientated towards that medium, and they were new, and they were fresh, and they were exciting, and they captured people's attentions, and people became sort of committed to watching them, you know, regularly.
Yeah, you talked about how interesting thing about television and how it was fitting into New Zealanders' lives at the time was that it was, you were alone in your living room with it. So in that sense, it was pushing people back into their homes to live their leisure time in their homes and not out in the pub or somewhere out on the, you know, in Europe would have been the squares, the village square, public squares, city squares. But at the same time, it was communal because every New Zealand family had that television in their lounges and were watching that show.
Pretty much, yeah. No, that's true. So in some ways, we, in our own isolation and in our privacy, we had a collective experience.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that's what was so unique about those young men, and you know, they were quite attractive to look at. They were quite captivating and enchanting too, as well. And so, I mean, we all watched them, and no one really commented on the fact that they were gay. No, there was a sort of silence around that. Mostly, I mean, I did used to watch them and think, surely someone's going to say something about this. Surely, because it was like the homosexual law reform hadn't happened yet, and it didn't for some time. I mean, it was 86, and we're talking about them being in our lives from 75 onwards, and primetime lives from 76. So they were really there, and no one really took them to task or... There was a few media things where they say, you know, there were a few leading questions, and Peter said, yes, we're very merry, but, you know, I mean, we were in response to the gay question, are you gay? Yes, we're very merry. So they were sort of, there was a silence around it which allowed it to happen in a time when homosexuality was illegal, when, you know, you could be arrested and jailed and all those sort of things. So it was a very much more conservative world than we live in today. We forget that.
They were quite risk takers in some ways, isn't it? They, by dancing so close to the edge in a country in which this was not a something you could talk about, like you were saying, the actual voice vocabulary was missing to be able to discuss this. But, you know, the answer to the question, and you talk about it in the book, that was, I think it's a quote from Noel Coward, I think you explained, that when they say, are you gay? And the answer is, yes, we are very merry, aren't yes. we? But it's saying yes. Yeah. It actually is yeah. a yes answer.
It is a yes answer.
And that's
yes.
very risk-taking.
It would have been.
Yeah.
I think they must have wondered, you know, what would happen. They must have often thought there would be more consequences, but I think New Zealand totally embraced them. And there was conservative elements as well. And maybe some people just said, hey, look, this doesn't matter, or I'm happy to watch this because they're so good at what they do and I'm laughing anyway. You know, I don't know what it was, but the most... I do know there was a certain amount of... probably quite a group of people who watched them and actually was sort of naive around those issues and didn't, they probably thought they were just flatmates or something. Yes. I mean, there was definitely a few people like that around.
But let's not forget there were also, so we talk about the conservative middle class New Zealand watching them and not taking it too far, not taking the realization too far because they were uncomfortable with going there and just let's just watch them for a fun evening. But there were also, as Peter Gordon has spoken about, a lot of New Zealanders, gay New Zealanders, who had never been allowed to see themselves presented in public with two happy people with living fulfilled lives. Mm-hmm. And he talked about being an adolescent gay and having not understood, you know, still having many areas to explore and unsure about. And there was something so important about being able to see these two men on public television.
Yeah, I think absolutely. There was this model wasn't there in the mainstream. And this model of relationship, this kind of ease about their sexuality, because I think that's what you saw, it wasn't there. And I think it was changing for gay people, for young gay people particularly, who were, I mean, there were some that cringed, because they found the camping thing uncomfortable. I have to say that. But there were many that were inspired by it, who saw it as the beginning of an acceptance, or at least someone that they could identify with that was in this relationship. And obviously flourishing, really, I think. So, but then not only did it change those lives and it also changed the mainstream. I do believe that being exposed to those men and their humour and their food and their relationship allowed New Zealanders to come to terms with gayness, even if it was through that kind of lens, and actually process that and see it as part of the mainstream, part of life, not something to be excluded or defined as vastly different. So I think it actually allowed New Zealand to move on, to forget itself, to forget its homophobia, and to embrace something different. So I think they were, even in their silences, they were profoundly and loudly life-changing for New Zealand.
Yeah, they were definitely pushing boundaries, is what I think the term that people use nowadays, weren't they?
Yes.
But interestingly, so the number one is the number one boundary that we're pushing here is clearly clearly sexual diversity.
Yes.
But wasn't there also I think my impression from reading the book is there's, well, you probably actually say it specifically in the book, come to think of it, about even encouraging New Zealanders to be braver about embracing all kinds of risk taking or diversity or making mistakes, because there was that very sort of middle class attitude at the time in New Zealand to cover up your flaws and not show when you'd made a mistake or the foibles that you might have, and fear of outrageousness.
Yes.
I think you definitely use that term.
Yeah,
the outrageous is a good term there.
I think that New Zealand was quite conservative, and we were very, quite BBC uptight, especially, I mean, if you look at some of the other presenters who were, you know, contemporary with them, they were much more rigid, and more uptight, I think, than they were. They seemed much more relaxed and easygoing and outrageous, and they embraced their mistakes, and they made jokes about them. And yeah, I think New Zealand was was New Zealanders generally found that quite an uncomfortable thing to do themselves. So they actually enjoyed watching someone else do it, and they saw it as a bit daring because they were prepared to admit they'd, you know, put salt in the sponge, left the top off the kitchen whiz so that it sort of sprayed around the, and also burnt the studio, you know. So they did all kinds of things, threw food over. They were just crazy, and they did embrace those mistakes. They called themselves cooks, not chefs. They were allowing New Zealanders to be more real about themselves too, I think.
Mm. And they were bringing something in. You used the term before. We talked about foreignness, which you know, is in this case, it was more about opening your mind to other lifestyles or other ways of thinking, more than particularly the person would come over from another country and speak a different language.
Yes.
We're talking of foreignness of, and there's a really good part in the book which I actually thought I might read, because I want to compliment you on the writing of this book. I've read lots of your books, and I'm just saying, getting better every time. Really, really good. Digging into mindsets and formation and psychological aspects, and not just, you know, giving us the narrative. And it's well done.
Thank you.
Top 100.
Thank you
but
very
the
much.
Really good discussion about alcohol, which in those days in New Zealand, of course, we had the 6 o'clock. Was it called the 6 o'clock closing time? But it wasn't called the six o'clock swill. Am I wrong? I wasn't here, but 6 o'clock swill. Yeah, and in fact, using alcohol instead in a different way, which is, you know, to add flavors to the food you're cooking, and to use it just socially at any time of the day or night, and perhaps many times of the day or night in the case of these two. But it says, you know, so. Adding alcohol to their cooking, it made cooking more ostentatious, and it was lifting many of the social and legal taboos around it. And so there's a paragraph here where you mention a few of their dishes: the chicken tarragon cream sauce with 2 cups of dry white wine, the coq au vin with 1/4 cup of good brandy and 2 cups of red wine, the bœuf bourguignon with 2 cups of good burgundy, and the chocolate rum souffle with 1 cup of dark rum and grapes soaked in brandies on. And they wrote, potent, but wow. And this is then what you say that's so wonderful. And it says, such dishes had an air of exotic flamboyance, not in the sense of being foreign, but rather of hedonistic indulgence, which was the closest thing to foreign that most New Zealanders knew. Peter and David's food was an antidote to the settler practice of self-denial.
Yes.
That's so well said. You can unpack that into so many captures, so many different facets of what we've been talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I must admit this, I wrote this book walking. So instead of sitting at my desk, which I find quite, I think it's a limiting thing for me, sitting down. And so moving with the words and moving with the ideas physically, I think it did actually change my writing. I can't believe that I can say that, but I honestly do believe it did. And it suited these characters and this story really well, but it's just the way it happened. So fantastic. I loved writing it. I loved it.
I think in some ways it loosened up. You know, you're known as a literary biographer, and this book is not a literary biography. It's a television biography in some ways. You know what I mean? And it goes a lot. I think there's more of you, more feeling in some ways, or more. I thought about this fact that also compared to The Search for Ann Perry, which is that The Search for Ann Perry is a book which is actually in some ways, if you look at the lives of these two women, it's a downer, we could say. Mm. Although there is an eventual turnaround and an ability to put creative, you know, to have made a creative contribution and lived a life, but it is a downer. This book, despite the incredible amount of tragedy, which I found in this book reading it, but at the core, as you say, Hudson and Hall's The Food of Love. At the core, there's a love story, which was a winning story, which they stayed together their whole lives.
They did.
And
and they achieved so much more together. They were that was the power of two, you know, to the power of two, really. That they achieved so much together, and they like you say, they stayed together, and they saw each other out of this world in a way, because and David left, you know, he committed suicide because he was just so brokenhearted and devastated to lose this partner of 28 years, 29 years nearly. And so it was, it is a, in a way, in many respects, it is a success story, because these two guys came to New Zealand. They made a life for themselves that they couldn't possibly really have had separately or in their own countries. So it's a New Zealand success story, because New Zealand embraced them and gave them an opportunity to be amazing and to be extraordinary. And that was something that, that's such a gift. And the fact that they were so intensely connected to each other is really a victory, because it says something about love and about how love can be and how it can last. And it, we don't, you know, and really we didn't have many of those stories, because we didn't record them, because we didn't admit to them. So it is, it's lovely, and it was a privilege to be able to share that with people.
I think it's really telling when you say about, you know, coming to New Zealand, because as you point out in the book, for example, with the David was from a working class family in England. His father was a laborer, his mother was a servant, and he did get a job as a shoe designer. He was already showing, you know, creativity and a desire to make a difference and go and take on his father's job. But he would always be contained, as you say in the book, by, as people were in England in those days, by what your background was, your accent, and your sexuality. And in coming to New Zealand, there was an aspiration to, well, it goes back to that risk-taking thing that I still continue to think of, this, you know, them on the show pushing the boundaries. And the same thing for Peter, you know, so he, coming to New Zealand, was looking for something more fulfilling, wasn't it? And they were willing to take risks. They were quite determined. And I think that possibly plays out also, you know, the suicide, it's... people think of it sometimes as a coward's way out. It actually takes a lot of courage and determination and looking at things with open eyes. And they certainly had a lot of sad things to look at with open eyes.
Yes.
Among which, you know, the decline of the television, of their television careers, which you describe heartbreakingly.
I think it was heartbreaking for them, because to some extent they saw it as a betrayal, you know, as a sort of, it was a grief, and I think they felt as if New Zealand had turned its back on them with the ratings and things like that. And but they held on to wanting to be New Zealanders right till the bitter end. They actually didn't leave New Zealand and move overseas till 1990, and Peter died in 92. So they held on to the last moment, when they hoped and believed that they might get a contract, that they might re-establish their program and their brand in New Zealand.
One of the things,
commitment.
Exactly, commitment. And I think what felt so tragic about the television thing leaving New Zealand to me was, you pointed out in the book, New Zealand was a very small market. And that, you know, when you talk about overexposure or so on, there's just so many things happening at one time in a country of, I don't know how many millions it would have been at the time, but, and so, you know, that was their other choice, was to go off to England, much larger market, you know, 50 times the number of people.
Yes.
But I could not believe the reviews that you quote. I was just dying inside when they put themselves out and they put the show on and they waited to get the reviews came in. And it was, I think this is another thing coming from New Zealand, where people are so kind.
Yeah.
And even when they are negative, they're very measured and careful and not personal about it.
Yeah.
Or try not to be personal. Everything's tried not to be personal. But the personal cruelty in the comments.
Yeah.
In those reviews about, you know, they might want to cook something with some kiwi fruits and ha ha ha, and
it was incredibly bad taste. And Actually, that wasn't supposed to be a pun, but it's breathtakingly vicious and cruel. I thought it was cruel and personal. The backdrop to this is AIDS, and by the time they were in the UK and being reviewed, we were still in that phase of fearfulness. Princess Diana was, you know, shaking hands with people with AIDS. She was kissing them on the cheek to tell the world that this was not an unsafe thing, that this was tragic rather than dangerous, or, you know, in terms of catching it, you know, in that casual contact. So in some ways there was a permission that these reviewers were granted by the bigger society to say stuff that would be totally inappropriate now, and I think wouldn't even get to print. But and there was, you know, like things about, you know, where have their hands been, or don't trust stuff like this. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you can't help thinking that was part of a whole permission, a social permission to take those attitudes because of the fear factor, and because people were vitriolic and nasty about the whole thing instead of understanding it, because it was still early days.
And there was possibly also a component of the colonialism of the upstarts from New Zealand coming over and trying to conquer British television. Definitely you could see the attitudes that David had tried to escape from. But, I keep coming back to this fact that at the heart of the book there is this really thrilling love story. And I thought that you might read another example of where I'm praising the wonderful writing skills that you've put into this book, the part about when they meet in New Zealand at a party.
Yes, at a party in Auckland in 1962. So Peter's just come to visit a friend. His name is Noel Combine, and Noel throws this surprise party for him.
Peter's flown over from Australia.
From Australia, absolutely. So minutes later, Peter looked across the room and saw David, 26 years old, with his blaze of golden hair and dazzling smile, standing at the mantelpiece. It was a life-changing moment of mutual attraction. Peter, tall, slender, and dark-haired with a Roman nose, was 31. The chemistry between them was instant and exclusive. For them, amid a crowd of people, there was no one else in the room. Even as an onlooker, Noel Combine saw the power of that first meeting, and with hindsight, its significance. From that point on, Peter and David were in each other's thrall. David's and my back doors were opposite each other, and I didn't see much of Peter for the rest of the 3 weeks. The nights were David and Peter's, Noel remembers. This new passion so inhaled the oxygen of their days together they could barely breathe, and in an instant their time together was gone. It could have been a 3 week fling, but it seemed they'd fallen in love. When it was time for Peter to go back to Melbourne, it was David, not Noel, who took him to the airport.
That part about the oxygen. Sorry, reread me.
I will.
Oxygen inhaling.
Okay, this new passion so inhaled the oxygen of their days together they could barely breathe, and in an instant their time together was gone.
That's so lovely. That's just so beautiful. It goes hand in hand with all of these sparkling qualities that they had. One which I keep coming back to is, you know, the wit. And my favorite line was when Peter dies and David sprinkles a small vial of his ashes in the planter of their favorite London restaurant. And as he's sprinkling it, he turns to the friend and says, "I hope it's his tongue." In acknowledgement, so really two larger than life characters, I'd say.
Absolutely.
And a larger than life book. I just want to say I think you've done such a great job with this book, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going to be coming next. So thank you for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thanks. My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day, every day, every day, every day.